The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report, special nuclear winter edition. Rick Bucher is joining us. He's getting to a landline. We would not let him do it by a cell phone. He is going to be on as we're doing this podcast in about eight to nine minutes. And it's a three-man weave. ESPN.com's Mark Stein in a studio right now. He's going to sound fantastic. And we are going to talk about, in my opinion, the dumbest sports lockout of all time. Steinimo, how are you feeling?
Dreadful. Pretty dreadful. I don't follow any other lockouts, so I can't verify your statement, but you pretty much have my signature on that one.
I'm really hard pressed to find any person who can explain to me how we're going to have a canceled season over. I had somebody tell me today that the key issues right now are sign and trade and mid-level exceptions. I mean, what does that affect? 20 people a year that we're going to lose a season over that?
Like, I'd say the escrow situation is another biggie too. But I'm just stunned that Billy Hunter has gotten these players to sign off on it. That's the stunner. And he surprised everyone yesterday. Everybody knew this was an option on the board, but the decertification guys weren't expecting a disclaimer. I'm sure the league, if they would tell us the truth, would say they were expecting Billy to get to the podium and say, we will put this deal to a vote immediately. If you make these 3 to 5 changes, he overshoots for what he wants. They come to some compromise, and there's your deal. Wow.
That's usually how negotiations work, right?
Well, plus,
you say one thing, I say the other thing.
You made the point on Twitter. Buke said it. A bunch of people said it. I think I wrote something to the effect at some point in the weekend that probably wasn't as colorfully as you guys said it. I mean, it was their chance to put the onus back on Stern. And if it didn't go any farther at that point, now David Stern's the bad guy.
Yeah.
Why they didn't seize that chance, God only knows.
He's still the bad guy. And everybody in this is a bad guy. And it's funny to hear these different writers like picking sides and stuff. I don't see how you pick a side in this. There's no side. There's no side to take. This is one of the dumbest, forget lockouts. This is just one of the whole dumbest sagas I can ever remember following. I just can't believe we've gotten to the point that we might lose a season. But first of all, from your research, why didn't they take this to a vote yesterday? This is a democracy, right? It's a players union. You have 450 players. They're all created basically equal. Why didn't they have a chance to vote on that proposal the NBA gave?
Basically, word spread from whether it's agents, whether it's from the union itself. And to be fair, I have talked to a lot of players who genuinely, genuinely hated the deal and thought it was garbage. That feeling was so strong that the union was basically able to cut off even the notion of a vote. And, if players feel that strongly, and again, I did talk to several that did, then, I can respect that. I think one of the big complaints here is for too long this summer, not enough players got involved in this and want to make their voice heard. Too many guys are either not interested or just willing to listen to whatever message they're being sent by, whether it's their rep or the union. And that's something else that just boggles my mind. I've asked guys, do you hear from your player rep? If I was a player rep, I'd be talking to Hunter every day, sending out emails to my guys with updates. That doesn't happen.
Well, you left out another party that they listen to is their agent. And the agents are the ones, over everybody else that hated this deal. And I think the agents have driven a lot more of this than you'd think. I still don't understand why you don't vote. If you're going to reject it, reject it. But at least after, what has this been? We're now month 5. It's the 4.5 month mark. At least vote on something. Let the world know, like, hey, we voted this down in the final number.
Billy Hunter's not going to cede control that easily. If he's put in these 2 years and overcome every threat to his throne that he has, he's not just going to say, okay, let's throw this thing to a vote. Which, again, I'm not so upset slash surprised about that. I mean, that I never thought that proposal was going to be voted on. You know, too many players didn't like it. But, you know, why not try to keep this thing going? Why walk away now when, you know, I mean, people want to bang on the agents, and I certainly understand that. But, I mean, there were a lot of agents telling Billy Hunter on July 1st, you guys got to decertify now. You've got to do this now. Yeah. And they waited 4 months, and now to dissolve the union is just a colossal waste of time.
And a colossal lack of leadership. And you just made the key point. Billy Hunter wasn't going to want to do that. Why do I care about what his intentions are or what's important to him? He's supposed to represent the players. This has become about Billy Hunter and David Stern.
No question. And you know, again, to credit something I saw on Twitter, Jonathan Fagan from the Houston Chronicle said it as well as I've seen it said. Ultimately, this rests with Stern. This is his league. His name is on the ball. It was his job to get a deal done. I totally, totally agree with that. But if we're going to dig a little bit deeper, you know, I'm just still stunned at the sway Billy Hunter has over a lot of these players, and that he just the road he's taken them down these last few months, this dissolving the union all could have been done so long ago, and all the bureaucracy time that would have been lost would have happened in August, September, October,
right?
Not when guys were supposed to be getting paychecks, not when we were supposed to be in arenas watching games, and you know. That is just a colossal, colossal mistake to me.
And that's the real problem with everything Billy Hunter has said. Because on the one hand, he's saying, I knew for 2 or 3 years that this day was going to come. Okay. Well, I'm glad you knew that. Well, if you knew that, then why didn't you decertify on July 1st? If you were that
damning,
convinced.
It's the most damning statement he makes. And he makes it every time he does media.
Yeah. And, you know, if you knew that, you knew this day was going to come, Billy Hunter. You've told us that, I think, 20 times publicly, maybe more, then to certify on July 1st. Then everything you should have been doing from January 1st to July 1st of 2011 should have been preparing for this day and preparing your guys and saying, look, these owners want to blow up the league. They want to totally change the system. And here is our best option legally to put pressure on them. Everything we need to do, July 1st, we're off. And the fact that he didn't do that, and it's mid-November, and now they're just talking about legitimately doing this, is a disgrace. And I think he should resign.
Now,
I think Stern should resign, too.
And you
do. I do. Look, I think both of these guys have totally, totally failed the people they're representing, and they should resign. Stern has clearly lost control of this entire process. I'm not even sure he has control of the owners anymore.
Well, that's the thing. The blame ultimately rests with him, number one on the list. He is the guy in charge. But there's this notion that he can wave a magic wand and end this thing at, you know, when he decides. And I just disagree with that. This is not 1999. He doesn't have 30 owners doing what he says. I think he maybe has 10.
Yeah.
The other 20 guys are telling him, David, we're losing too much money, and they all have their different there are different world views of, you know, what they need, just like players. Every owner's different too. And he can't just impose his will on these guys and set policy like he did in 1999. I do not think he can do it.
To me, there's been so many different lessons from the past 5 months. One is that I just think Billy Hunter is trying to keep his job at this point. And this whole legal process allows him to keep his job and keep some sort of standing and keep the machine rolling, so to speak, because if he accepts the deal that the owners gave that the players didn't really like, then they're going to blame him and he becomes the bad guy. And it's all about, oh, we accepted this bad deal because Fisher and Hunter screwed up. And this whole legal process, all that does is allow them to drag things along and throw people off the scent of the fact that they effed this up for 2 solid years. They did. Show me any evidence that they didn't totally F this up. I mean, seriously, do you feel like, imagine these guys were in control of your life. Would you feel good about it right now if they were in charge of your career and your next contract? Would you feel good about that?
Especially because he keeps admitting every interview the guy does. I've seen this coming for 2 or 3 years, but yet I'm going to sit back and do the exact same thing I did in 1999 and let us get dragged to January with no deal and no, you know, hopefully yeah. it'll work out then. Now, I'm sure if you had him on again, he would say, well, how could we have decertified or disclaimed on July 1st and then made the claim that we were bargaining in good faith? We had to bargain after July 1st to claim that we were bargaining in good faith. Okay, fine. You could have dissolved August 1st. You could have dissolved September 1st. Even October 1st would have been better than what we're looking at now. There were so many chances to do this. And like you said, so many people around the league saw this coming. And again, though, I've got to put some blame back on the players for not. I mean, he works for them. And I don't think they challenged him enough to change policy.
Yeah, but this goes back to the whole question of you can't really expect the players to know what to do in this type of situation. Like, they're not business guys. They're guys who went to high school and went to either 1, 2, 3, 4 years of college, and they play basketball for a living. How should they know? How should they know how to handle a business negotiation that involves $4.5 billion a year or whatever it is? It's their job.
Look, to negotiate the finer points. Yeah. To negotiate the finer points of a deal, I agree with you. But the basic premise, I think you got to give them more credit. And I think, to be fair, some guys have been very outspoken. Your guy, Pierce. You know, I heard a story about a regional meeting, you know, at some point earlier in the summer where he basically did jump out and say, Billy, what's the plan? What are we doing? Tell me where we're going. And he didn't get the answers. And that's probably why he became, you know, the most vocal player in the decertification movement, because he did press him and say, where are you going with this? And I just think it was too easy in the summer for guys to tune out. They're not getting paid in the summer anyway, and just take the it'll all work out stance. And
yeah, but hold on, though. Because Batty, I also challenged him. It seems like a couple of these guys have. Even Kevin Martin yesterday, it seemed like he was a little upset that they didn't vote on it. And you know, I'm disappointed that more players haven't at least publicly questioned, you know, what the leadership of this whole thing is. But the part I don't get is, you know, everybody knew this whole season that we're headed toward this point or something close. Why did they not negotiate until mid-October? I've never heard a good answer for that. I asked Hunter, I've asked Stern, and both guys are like, well, look, there's nothing to negotiate. The other side is totally irrational. And it's like, they should have been negotiating from January to June. When the league was doing fantastic.
But as a practical matter, we know that's never going to happen. I mean, look, we're not professional negotiators either, because it's a leverage thing. This is big business with billions of dollars at stake, and these are the kind of games they play in negotiations.
Well,
it's all about leverage.
Failed.
Well, I mean, it's easy to say that now, but look, the league.
It was
felt
easy
like
to say it in June. What are you talking about?
The league.
We knew this was headed toward this point.
The league felt like it had 100% of the leverage. And
they did.
Exactly. We're not going to argue with them. So they used that leverage to dictate the timetable they wanted. But I mean, where we are now, it was around October 5th where the whole 50-50 concept was introduced to the public. There was so it's been a while now that this has been out there and they haven't been able to close the gap. I mean, they've worked on this for a good solid month. We could have had 82 games. And we could have had 72 games. We could have gotten through this without really missing all that much.
Except for the part that in June I was writing. Ooh, is somebody there?
Yeah.
Duke?
I'm here.
Hey. We were just talking about why this situation. Why it took so long for both of these sides to start seriously negotiating. Do you buy this whole thing about it's all just part of the game and negotiating and all that crap? Do you feel like they should have started sooner?
I felt from last year, and I was hearing last year already, that the owners and the GMs in how they were structuring contracts was in anticipation that they would not be paying those contracts this season, or they would only paying part of them. this season, and that's why you saw. I mean, you remember that big glut of contracts, ridiculous contracts that were given out, and everybody was like, why are they doing this?
Amir Johnson.
And the word that I got back was, hey, we're about to have a lockout. we're not going to pay these entire contracts. Now,
yeah.
I do believe that they could have started negotiating earlier, but it would have required the players and the players' union to say at the All-Star break, look, we don't want a lockout. We don't want an interruption. So unless you're willing to negotiate in good faith, when it comes to July 1, we're going to decertify. We're going to go straight to the courts. We're going to push that button, because they have been having casual talks for the longest time, but there was no sense of urgency, and clearly the lack of urgency was on the owner's part. I mean, when the players come to the table and immediately give up 4% of BRI,
they should have.
That's a clear indication that they want to make a deal. And I felt that from the very beginning. I feel it now. They want to make a deal. They had no way of getting the owners to come to the table and make a deal unless it was completely in the owner's favor.
It should have been in the owner's favor. They have all the leverage. I don't understand why
well,
it wouldn't be in the owner's favor.
That's what I love about this. And I honestly believe we had to have this happen. I'm glad that this happened, because above and beyond really forcing the issue now, if you guys don't want to get locked up in court, you've got to talk to each other and you've got to negotiate on both sides. But there was also just an overall sense of arrogance toward the other. It started last summer. It's continued with Dwight Howard and Chris Paul and these guys sort of taking LeBron's lead and saying, hey, well, you know what, we'll play wherever we want to. It's almost like the teams and the GMs and the owners are not, you know, we're going to play where we want to play. Well, look, I appreciate the freedom of movement and the desire to do that, but you don't do it in a way that says, hey, you know what, I'm really in charge. You may think you own the team, but I really drive the bus.
Wait a second.
And on the flip side, the owners are like, yeah, we don't have to do special things for our players. It's become a tug of war that I believe they needed to be reminded that they need each other, because the way they have been operating over the last year, it's been too much of a battle over who really owns and controls the league. And the fact of the matter is that they can't do without each other, but they've been trying. They've been trying to create this scenario where, you know what, we can live without you. That's what both sides have been saying to each other. And now, you know, they're going to have to come to terms, or then neither one of them gets to play and neither one of them has control, because the judges and the lawyers do.
Steinie Mo, and then I'm going to ask Buick the same question after. Steinie Mo, you read this last owner's proposal, and I thought Howard Beck did a nice job of laying out, if the players had accepted the last proposal, here's what the league might look like. And I read the article, and I was prepared to be like, yeah, there's going to be some dumb stuff in here. And I'm going through it, and I'm like, that makes sense. Well, that's logical. That makes sense. I read the whole thing, and I'm like, wow, every single thing in that article made sense. So I handed it to my dad. Dad, read this. Go through this and tell me what doesn't make sense. So he reads it, and he goes, yeah, that all made sense. The league would be better. I mean, Steinie Mo, first you. When you know all the problems that this league has, and how many dumb contracts get handed out, and how many middle-class guys are overpaid, and what a problem it is where you have guys who can basically decide, I don't want to play here anymore, I'm going to force my way there and then get a giant extension. This proposal did address almost all of those problems, right?
That's a huge problem. I totally agree. I mean, I think it must suck for someone who really loves the Orlando Magic to know that as soon as we start, whenever this starts again, that they're going to have to be subjected to, you know, Muppets like Buick and I talking about Dwight every single day until he resigns or he leaves. That's the reality of today's NBA. And you know, they certainly can't make that all go away with any agreement they come up with, but you do have to feel sympathy for fans of the Magic and the Hornets and the Nets, who, you know, maybe it's not as dire for them because they got Prokhorov now. But, you know, what the Nuggets had to go through last year, where it was just 4 or 5 months of every single day, just this draining dialogue about what's going to happen with Melo. So, yeah, competitive balance. I think obviously it would be great if there was a way to give small market teams a better chance to compete. I don't know that this system was really going to be the Band-Aid and the cure-all for that, but yeah, it's gotten out of hand with just a small market team that is lucky enough to draft a franchise player has to have a better chance of keeping him. People are pointing at San Antonio like, hey, they did it in a small market. Anybody can.
Yeah, it's a
no,
fluke.
As great as they are, they will be the first ones to tell you, we were in the lottery twice and we got Duncan and Robinson. That is the
right.
main reason why the Spurs have been successful. They did a zillion other good things on top of it and have great people working there. But it doesn't matter if you don't have that franchise player.
And also, like, with the, you know, that proposal they did, one of the things I liked about it was you could sign your own player for 5 years, and if you wanted to go somewhere else, he could only sign for 4 years. That makes sense to me. If you're LeBron James, you're walking away from an extra year of security to go play for somebody else in 2010. At least that makes you think a little bit. And the other thing, you know, how many contracts have we made fun of with these terrible mid-level contracts and these guys getting paid twice as much as they should make? And the player's argument is, hey, it's not our fault they give out dumb contracts. They should look in the mirror. And it's like, well, take some responsibility, guys. It's bad for you that you have bad players who are getting paid 3 or 4 times what they're worth. Like, it makes the fans not like you. Buke, do you think that they should care about that?
Do I think they should care about what?
Do you think they should care about the fact that when they have guys that get overpaid with dumb deals, and it's mostly the middle class guys, and it's guys
that nobody goes to pay to get the seat. You're holding them to a standard that you would never hold yourself to.
Why?
If some media company out there wanted to quadruple your salary, you're gonna just say, oh, you guys are being idiots.
Here's why I think it does matter, because think of all the time that we've spent over the last, I don't know, 10, 12, 13 years talking about how many dumb contracts have been handed out. And what the owners have basically tried to do is reallocate how they spend their money. They're putting in checks and balances for themselves, and the players and the agents are like, no, we don't want you to have checks and balances. We want you to continue to hand out these stupid contracts. And I can kind of see the owner's side on this. They can't help themselves from handing out stupid contracts. Do you sympathize with that a little bit?
Well, look, number one, I agree with Steiny Moe that you're holding them to a standard that we ourselves do not hold ourselves to. Because if anybody in our business gets a huge contract, there may be a little bit of resentment or whatever, but we're not going to look at it and say, hey, you know, we're not going to hate on that guy because he got a ton of money. Whether we think it's justified or not. But the other part is, I'm not opposed. And look, I wish two things. I wish that they had the ability to get out of bad contracts. And I wish they had the ability to reward guys who are much better than we expected them to be sooner. That I don't believe that anybody would be opposed to that. And that's actually, you know, that was one of the things that they had in their previous proposal,
yeah,
where guys would be rewarded. There was a performance incentive, and that was not in this proposal. What I don't like is that they have these artificial ceilings, and it's not they're not looking for relief from bad contracts. They're trying to eliminate altogether anybody signing a big contract, and that to me is just wrong. And they can say all they want about, I mean, the fact that they presented it as, hey, look, we got three exceptions. We added an exception. Yeah, but you can only use one of them. It's not like you can use all three.
Then counter it. When you do a counter proposal and counter it and say, hey, we like most of the framework of this deal, but instead can we do this, this, and this? You don't just certify.
Y-
come back with a different proposal.
I would agree with that. That's what I sort of expected them to do at this point, is to flip it back at them. And I still don't have a clear answer as to why they didn't take that step first, because that would have won the PR battle, maybe for the first time, in turning the tables and basically doing to the owners essentially what they've done to them. But I will say this too, and this goes to the heart of, and I got caught up in this because they put out their summary of the proposal. What the NBA has publicly said, and even in terms of the summary that they put out, is not entirely what they have presented the players with in those meetings, as far as this is what we have to have to make a deal. And yeah, so I just don't trust, you know, what has been put out there as far as the league saying, hey, this is what we'll do and this is how it'll work. And yeah, we have 30. I mean, literally, I had this said to me, we have like 30 B-list issues that we'll negotiate after the fact, you know, after the fact, if only the players will agree to these main points. And I'm like, 30, like if there's 30 things, and whether it's the D-League element or drug testing, you can't have that many undetermined things and agree to the main points. There's no way that those other things don't impact the main points. So I get the feeling like they just wanted to ramrod these particular points through, and then once the players have agreed, if they don't have any leverage now, once you've agreed to the main points, now you really don't have any leverage to go back and negotiate those other things.
But with the proposal that they gave, it didn't seem like it affected the upper class guys. It seemed like the guys that were really going to be affected were the middle class guys. And you know, you could make a case that maybe those guys should have been affected. And if you're pulling out 7%, if you're going from 57% revenue for the players to 50%, all right, well, where's that money coming from? Obviously, it should come from the middle class, because if you just look at all the contracts they've handed out over the last 10 years, the most mistakes, the most overpaid guys, the most, I wish we hadn't done those contracts, the most, I need to trade this contract to get it off my cap. They're all the middle-class contracts for the most part. You very rarely do you have a Rashard Lewis situation. You have many more Luke Walton situations. You have many more Travis Outlaw situations. Those are the contracts that kill these teams. So
but
why
the
not
counter
address
you'd
that?
Get, the counter you'd get from the player-slash-agent side, and I do think there's truth here, is it's not even that the mid-level's going to be used, but if you need it as a leverage point to promote player movement, that's what they're saying. And that's why there's so much talk about the mid-level. I mean, because we've gradually seen the mid-level be actually used less and less as time
right.
has gone on.
Because
and
it's
as
a
so
bad
many,
contract.
Right, as so many of these guys have not lived up to the money. But just having the option of it does promote player movement. And that's one of the things they're so upset about.
You just proved my point. You just said because so many players haven't lived up to the contract. Isn't that part of the reason why we're having this lockout? Like, I don't understand. The owners, listen, I think they were bullies. I think they wanted to have a lockout, to lock out part of the season. I think they wanted these guys to miss checks. I think the way they handled this was really obscene, and I think Stern should resign because he's clearly lost control not only over part of his owners, the players do not respect him anymore.
So who's taking over if Stern resigns?
Adam Silver. I don't know.
Great question.
Come on, man.
No. See, but that's the problem with either saying that David Stern should go or even, quite honestly, whether Billy Hunter should go.
Both should go. Both of them should go.
I say this the same with GMs. I say it with head coaches. You can't. I don't buy into anybody saying, "Hey, that guy has got to go," unless you can tell me who it is should be taking over. If you don't have that guy,
he's a bully. He's a dictator.
That somebody else is going to do something better.
Call him whatever you want: bully, dictator, emperor, whatever you want to say. I don't see how you don't look at his balance sheet and say, I mean, how many better commissioners have there been than him? I think even if he's made mistakes in this process, you know.
Mistakes? We're not going to have a season.
You got to give him some benefit of the doubt here. I mean,
I do.
Is there anyone capable of taking his place right now?
Well, who's going to do worse? He's turned it into a situation where the players, they don't even care about the deal anymore. They're all about just standing up to him and standing up to the owners. And that's what this lockout has become about. It's a poker match. And these guys are like, I don't care if I have two threes. I'm going all in. You're not going to bully me out of this hand. I think it's BS.
Okay. What is if ultimately, and I go back to this because I believe that this had to happen. I believe that we needed to have a reset. That what they were doing, and even with this deal, it's patching a larger issue, which is the relationship and the perspective of this new group of owners and this current crop of players. That there is a lack of perspective on both sides. And I, quite honestly, if they miss a season and they come back with a different approach, then this isn't a bad thing. Missing a season is not a bad thing because they needed to change how they do business. And here's going back to your point about, you know, they need to have these protections and all that. I would be fine with that if the best players in the league didn't always also have an artificial ceiling. That if it wasn't that we are going to put a cap on what everybody can do. And here's the truth of it. I mean, this is the worst part. If you are a second round pick or you're a guy that wasn't making money, and why should there be an artificial restriction on you to be able to make above the mid-level exception? Why should you not, based on your accomplishments, be able to get more money? And that's the problem with the way this is structured. And when we get to the whole leverage thing, is the way it is your team doesn't have to compete for your services. No matter how you play, they're not going to have to pay you more because there's nobody out there that can compete for you. And that's the issue that I have. If you make yourself into maybe not a great player, but a player better than you were, then why shouldn't you be able to make $6-7 million rather than $3 or $4 million?
Well, wait a second. Give me an example.
I just feel
give
it's
me an example
un-
of a
it's
player.
Unfair. What's
well,
that?
Give me an example of a player because I'm not sure I'm totally following you here. Like, what? Give me a scenario where this happened, where the player didn't do what, where he didn't get what he should have.
I'd have to go look at that. I don't have anybody in particular.
David Lee.
All right, David Lee. So David Lee is.
I threw that out just to inflame, just to get you going.
Oh yeah, BUK case David Lee. So David Lee, underpaid for four years or 5 years, I can't remember. 4 years, and then the Warriors overpaid him and gave him an $86 million deal. I would argue that things worked out for David Lee, right? I mean, Jared Dudley is somebody.
But now the pendulum swings the other way. And how much of what David Lee did was that the particular scenario that was set up because we had that whole LeBron James bonanza?
But you're advocating that for the good of the sport, players should not want to take an outrageous offer. I mean, that's just never going to happen.
I'm not advocating that. I'm just saying that if it were up to me, if you're gonna knock that revenue down from 57% to 50, the best way to do it is to put a little more checks and balances on the middle class guys. You know, and I think let's look at Barea on your beloved Dallas Mavericks. Under the old system, somebody would have paid him $35 million to be their change of pace third guard. Do you think he's worth that $35 million?
Every cent.
Would you do that as a GM? You would really do that to your salary cap? You would.
I don't know if I would, but you're right. Somebody would have.
Right. So that's a bad system because the system is just – here's the other thing that people don't realize. Like, these guys own a team. They live in a city. They get hammered by me, by the bloggers, by the beat reporters, by the fans. You know, they have cap space. People are like, why didn't they sign Barea? They had $7 million. We need a third guard. And they get panic and they get pressured into doing stuff that they probably shouldn't do. And I think we forget that part, is that we always wonder, like, why do these guys make so many dumb contracts? And it's because they're just terrified. They're literally
afraid. We're all
to
blame
of
on some level. On some level, we're all to blame. I mean, certainly the way we've covered this thing in the media, so much more is exposed. So many letters and private conversations. You know, we're at the heart of all that. And there's no question that has an impact on, you know, in 1999, there was silence for weeks because we had none of these platforms to disseminate the news like we do now. But as much as I hate to say it, even the fans, because the ones who love this game so much, they say, I'm done with the NBA and I'm never coming back. They're lying. They're coming back, and the league knows they're coming back. And that's a factor, too. They know that even if they sit out a year, eventually they will recover.
I think you're
right. To me, that's the biggest canard here. Like,
no,
oh,
they will.
The damage they're doing, and it's never going to be the same. Look, the last time we had a lockout, which they did not intend at that point, Michael Jordan was retiring, and there was nobody to pick up that mantle. And we were coming off of an era where the basketball had become rather unattractive. We are now at a point where they had record numbers of people watching, and you look at the array of stars in the league and the up and down style, whether you agree, you know, if you're a basketball purist, you may like it, you may not like it, but the fact of the matter, it's an incredibly exciting style. It's a fast paced style, and you have like 8 to 10. I mean, let's go back to, you know, our MVP talks last year. You had like 10 guys in the conversation. And that wasn't because it was middling. It was because you had so many phenomenal players that you wanted to see. There's nothing I get tired of more than somebody saying nobody cares or they're going to go under. It's not true. And honestly, I believe that that's what fueled the owner's position, is like, you know what? If there's any time for us to do this, we should do it now. And this gets to something, Bill, you brought up of like, I saw you tweet about, why don't we just sign a 2-year deal and then go back to the negotiations? Because 2 years from now, the economy will have potentially changed and we'll be in a different place with these stars. This is the ideal time for the owners to take the players and take them to the wall. And the one mistake I feel that they made is they overreached. They went too far. If they had simply, look, the players had 6 points coming off of the previous offer that they said, if you'll just give us some relief on these, we're good to go. We've given you 50-50. I mean, giving up 7% of BRI, that was huge. And the owners are like, nah, we're not doing that. We're not doing this. We're not doing this. And by the way, we want the D-League thing, and we want year-round drug testing. I mean, they pummeled them to the point where I don't begrudge the players at all for going to this, because the owners were just, they were overboard in what they were asking for.
Yeah. But wait a minute. Hey, there's only one of us on this call who pays for tickets. So you tell us. I mean, you, the guy who was addicted to the NBA, are really that turned off and you're not going to come running back in a year?
I think you guys are. Here's the problem. You guys, you are basketball reporters. Everybody that you deal with in your lives relates to, in your professional lives, relates to basketball in some way. And because I write about all sports and I hear from different types of fans and different types of people, I do think people are really turned off by this. And I think the attitude is, I don't care. I hope that two sides blow each other up. And that really seems to be the attitude. I think
it's talk. It's appalled. All, I say it's all
not talk, Steinemo.
Listen, God bless every single person that we would put in that category, because they're the consumers that keep us in business. And, I do not want to, belittle them or not take it seriously. But nothing could be more damaging to this sport than the Donaghy scandal. That was something that jeopardized the credibility of the league and threatened, if it blew up, to turn this thing into wrestling. And it's only been 4 years later and we don't hear a peep about that. It's not even it's not a factor. I mean, people say the brawl in Auburn Hills and the Donaghy thing, and I'm done with the NBA, and it's just not true.
Here's where you're
wrong. I would be far more concerned about the league if people weren't as disgusted as they are, and if I didn't hear the outcry of, man, I just want to watch games. Why aren't they giving me my games? But that's what I'm hearing. And are people genuinely turned off? I think is the wrong description. Are they legitimately angry and frustrated? Absolutely. But it's because they loved what they got last year, and they want more of it, and they know it's waiting there for them. And you just can't tell me that when they get this thing back together, as I believe they will, and I believe we have a better chance. It's going to be definitive now. We're either going to get a deal shortly, or we're not going to have a season at all. And I believe either way, it's a good thing, but now finally they have to go to the wall and get it done. But once they do, I'm not convinced that passion among the fans that we are feeling right now is going to evaporate. I believe it's why they're going to come back.
You're hearing the passion from the diehard fans. I'm telling you what the casual fans are thinking. And here's the difference between 99 and 2011. There's more stuff to do now. And the difference between Donaghy and the Artest melee and not having a season is it gives people a chance to form different habits and to figure out, ooh, here's how I'm going to spend my Wednesday night now that I don't have any basketball to watch. And that's when it gets dangerous. For instance, I love going to hockey games. I couldn't love having my Kings season tickets anymore. They're more fun than the Clipper tickets. And I'll tell you what, if I have a choice next year between the Kings and the Clippers, I'm getting the Kings tickets. It's more fun. It's more consistently
no
fun to go
way.
To the games.
Yeah, but I do not
believe you.
Listen, you cannot believe me all you want. It's more fun to go to the games. I'm just telling you.
To go to the games, where there's no question to go to a hockey game is a great experience. But that's not what the NBA is built on. That's not what makes the NBA so popular. It's because it's on TV and it's a TV-friendly sport. And it will always continue to be that.
Okay,
that
it's a
way.
TV-friendly
and that's why,
sport.
That's where the mainstream access is. So
yeah, and that's why we're having a lockout.
Yeah, but you can't possibly compare, hey, you know what, I went to a hockey game and it was great, and now hockey's going to take over basketball? Stop it. You talk about a boutique sport.
Hold on. Wait a second. You're putting words in my mouth. All I'm saying is the fact that there's no basketball gives people a chance to do other things where normally they would have watched basketball. And right now, I like going to Kings games because I don't have basketball games to go to. And now we're at the point that 9 months from now, if I have a choice between Kings and Clippers, I'm picking the Kings. I hate to break into the Clippers, but that's how it's going to play out.
Can you turn the lie detector on?
It's not a lie detector. It's more fun. The fans are more fun. The Clipper fans just sit there. They don't do anything. Like, I'll just watch the games on TV. I don't care.
So now, you had never gone to a hockey game before?
I went to a lot of hockey games.
Hockey before?
Hockey's more fun in 2011.
Why is the game so much better in 2011 than it was 5 years ago when you went?
Because they missed a season.
They blew up the system, and they changed it.
Oh, really?
Two
years ago, why wasn't it better?
It was better. I just was slow to come back because I was too obsessed with the NBA. Bottom line.
Yeah. So Blake's last couple of years in LA, you're going to be at Kings games instead of watching the Clippers.
I gotta be honest. I think you're underestimating. You're underestimating how disgusted I am with this whole lockout and how much I hate what's happened. And I don't want to give these guys my money anymore. It's my choice.
I am. I'm totally underestimating it.
And you are underestimating how well we know you and how quickly you will flip back the other way, as you have on so many things, Mr. Weathervane. You're headed in one direction. This is it. I'm done with them. Where do I sign up?
You were Mr. Players Union on Twitter this weekend.
What's that?
you were Mr. Players Union on Twitter this weekend. You were Mr. Players Union.
Hey, does hockey have a trade? Does hockey have a trade machine? Are you doing hockey trades in your spare time?
Can we? I want to go back to something Buke said. He was
Answer that question.
Hockey trade machine. I can talk myself into. Look, I'm gonna do. I'm gonna make do. I'm gonna make do with whatever my options are. Buke, let's go back to something you said about the TV revenue and the fact that attendance matters less and less, and you can watch these games on TV. People love it. Isn't that one of the reasons we're having this lockout? Because the owners are terrified about where attendance is going?
Attendance at games is certainly an issue, but I think that's an issue. That's a pan sport issue, in that people don't go to the games because it's so much easier to watch on TV. The one thing, the one great advantage, again, that basketball has, I think over baseball in particular, football is just kind of in and of itself,
right,
is that basketball is so TV friendly. So I don't, look, I think every owner of every team in every league is concerned about the fact that the viewing experience at home has become so good that the issues of going and watching live make it a challenge. But again, you know, I look at the way some of these new arenas are built, the fact that you are inside, the fact that they are doing everything they can to create a complete fan experience, that you're not going. See, I question whether it's that they're not going to NBA arenas or they're not in their seats. And that's a different thing. And again, it gets to the heart of how you're making your money. You're not making your money just because somebody is sitting in their seat. You're making your money because they bought that ticket and they're in the building buying concessions and doing an array of other things. And from what I see, there's still plenty of that going on.
People are always going to want good seats for a basketball game. The thing that's changed is that people no longer want bad seats for a basketball game. And that's what's changed since we've all been alone.
And that's why I believe that's why arenas, you know, they have to become more intimate, and they have to become smaller. And you also, the big question, and you and I were on a panel at the Sloan Conference, and I think this is at the heart of everything, is you've got to be able to see replay at your discretion, and you've got to have the Wi-Fi. You've got to have access to all of that from your seat. And the big X factor to me in all this is having 18,000 people in one place and allowing them all to be able to text and have Wi-Fi service so that they can do all the things that they would do if they were sitting on their couch. Then you are able to leapfrog the experience that you have on your couch. And I'll say this when it comes to basketball. You're dealing with 15,000, 18,000, 20,000. I have to believe that it's going to be easier to address that issue with that group as opposed to the numbers that you're going to get in baseball or football, which you're trying to address in football. You're trying to provide that service for 60,000 people. That's a whole different animal, I have to think.
Well, I think the other issue is that you have these state-of-the-art, quote-unquote, NBA arenas that maybe aren't state-of-the-art anymore. If I was building an arena, I would make it 11,500 or 12,000, something like that, and really make it an awesome place. I don't care about the upper deck people. I care about suites, and I care about people between the baskets, and I care about people being able to text and do all the things they would normally do and make it so that when they come to a game, it kind of resembles what it would be like to watch on the couch. Steiny Moe in Dallas, that hasn't been a problem. Dallas is an anomaly, though, right?
What, as far as people loving the whole scene there?
Just being 20,000 fans showing up for games. Like, that's not really happening in every NBA city.
No, the people in Dallas, I mean, you have to say, they put up with a lot of playoff disappointment and stuck with this team. The crazy thing was when last season started, the Mavs had really slipped to number three in importance in this town because the Rangers had just gone to the World Series
Cowboys.
And lost to the Giants. But people still kept coming out. And yeah, I think you're right. It's not a common phenomenon.
Let's go back to the Stern Hunter thing for a second. Do you really think that these guys at this point in the process can actually get a deal done? Because it seems like there's so much bad blood at this point that it's just inconceivable to me that they could work this out in the next couple of weeks. And it seems like if they don't, there's no season. Steiny Moe,
I think they can get on the phone and talk this out, and they need to do it ASAP. But I think what we've seen is that I don't know that either one necessarily can just ram a deal through like they've been able to in the past.
Yeah.
There are a lot of factions on the player side now. And, you know, as we've talked about, Stern cannot make 30 owners bend to his whim like he could in 1999 or even 2005. So even if they come to some kind of agreement, they've got to get their constituents to sign off on it. And that's tougher than it sounds.
That's the biggest issue here, is that it's not, and again, that's why I can't put all of this on David and Billy, because they don't have, it's not like those two can work it out. It's not like we have two sides trying to reach an agreement. We have like four groups within each that are trying to serve their own agenda, and the guys up top are responsible for trying to bring all those guys together. Well, the problem is that I don't know that there's one prevailing group. You know, David doesn't have the base of owners that will just follow him. I don't know that he even has a lieutenant among the other owners. I mean, you have presumably Peter Holt is that guy in this group. Now, does Peter Holt have the kind of sway over Jim Dolan and Jerry Buss that a Jerry Colangelo once had? I don't believe so. And so that's the problem, is that who are their lieutenants? And Derek Fisher has demonstrated, you know, we had an image of him. And I think going into this, we all thought, okay, if there's one guy that everybody will listen to, it'll be this guy. And I don't know if anybody has done more damage to his image than Derek Fisher, in terms of what we've learned and the reaction of other players and how they look at him, and how we've learned about maybe how they've looked at him all along.
Yeah.
But that's the problem. It's not just the guy up top, but you need to have a lieutenant who is able to go and meet one-on-one with people and convince them that you need to get something done. And Adam Silver, to a certain extent, has been able to do that, but he's been able to do that with the newer owners. I don't know that he carries that sway with everybody.
And, you know, I was a poli sci major, and a big part of poli sci is trying to figure out why certain things in history happen, and there's things you can learn from it, bigger theories and all that kind of stuff. And the one theme that you hear over and over again, or that you read when you're reading this stuff, is like, a lot of times dumb things happen because you have these two sides that are just poorly run and stuck in their ways, and they just kind of collide like two cars going head on. And I look at this, and this is why I was saying I think Stern and Hunter either need to resign or step aside or do something. Like you just said Stern has basically lost control over most of his owners, except for he's got, I think, like maybe 10 that are following him. Hunter has Fisher as his, I guess, lieutenant, and he's lost the trust of the players. I think everybody's lost trust of Hunter. You have all these people running this process,
right,
that – except for the 10 guys who believe in Stern, it doesn't seem like anybody believes in. So why are these the people still running the process?
Because we don't – who's the alternative at this point? I mean, if you talk about wanting to salvage the season and get something done now
– that's all I care about.
If you're going to hit the reset with the leaders, goodness gracious. I mean, Billy and David, at least they have each other in terms of, you know what, my survival depends on the other guy. I mean, if there's any two guys motivated to work together, It's those two guys. If you bring in brand new people, now you have a reset. Now they have to develop a relationship. They have to develop trust. I mean, if the season is lost, if we're going to go dark and we're not going to negotiate again until next summer at the earliest, then I would say, sure, you know what? Let's put some new people up top and because we'll give them time to get to know each other and to establish their platforms and their positions and gather their particular constituencies and be able to come to the table and say, okay, we're starting clean, we're starting fresh, this is where we are. But at this point, if you do that at this point, then you're not only conceding this season, you're putting next season in jeopardy in terms of when the negotiating would begin and whether they can get a deal done.
Well, am I too cynical? I feel like we've already conceded this season. I mean, I don't see this game.
I'm still not. I mean, it looks incredibly bleak, but I'm still gullible enough to say that it's November. It's November 15th. I mean, it's just, it's too soon.
I believe that if the owners want to have a season, and this is the question that I've long had and, you know, ultimately will have answered, if the owners want to have a season, they can have a season. They were not that far apart. The players capitulated on an awful lot. They were asking for a few. Look, they even bought in to, the by and large, the system. All they wanted was, don't make the tax, the luxury tax, so severe. Add $1 million to the mid-level exception that tax-paying teams can use. If they had given on some of those, if they gave the players some way of saying, okay, you know what, we lost training camp, we lost summer, we lost a paycheck, but we at least salvaged this. But they gave them none of that, and that's why I have the greatest issue with the owners. And you're saying that I was tweeting on behalf of the players union. When I looked at what I heard that the owners put on the table Thursday, and what the players were just, give us something. I've been hearing this for a month from players. Give us something where we can say, you know what, we didn't just get cleaned out. We didn't just get completely wiped out in these negotiations. And the owners, I mean, I ask both of you, you tell me where the owners conceded anything in these negotiations.
Well, I don't think that they ever intended to have a season unless the players met them at a certain point. And that was their leverage. And I don't think it was about conceding. I think it was about, we're not going to continue to do this unless we meet at this point. And I think the mistake the owners made was saying, this is an ultimatum. You have until this day to accept it, or this offer will never appear again, and we're going to – I mean, it was like, give me a break. Who
but
negotiates
you have, I mean,
like that?
But in negotiations, there's always ultimatums. I mean –
not like that. That's not a negotiation. That's putting a gun to somebody's head. That was terrible.
But again, if the union had just done – what I think we all thought they were going to do with coming back with 3 to 5 demands of their own.
They'd already done that on the previous offer.
Not publicly, not like that. Not to go in front of a microphone and tell the world, if you make these 3 to 5 improvements, we will put the deal to a vote right now.
Give me a pen. We need these 3 to 5 things. Give us a pen. We'll sign it. But we need these things. We've given all this stuff. Do these 3 to 5 things for us, and we have a season.
Okay.
Why not?
You know what? I can't dispute that they could have taken it to the public. But the idea that they hadn't already – I mean, look, initially David Stern said, this is the take it or leave it. And they still managed to come back and say, hey, look, here are 6 things that we'd like changed with that offer. And the owner said, no, 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 no. Okay, you know what? We'll give you a revised offer. But it didn't address any of the things that the players brought up. So
right.
I agree with you in terms of they could have taken that one last attempt. But it's not as – I part of it for me is none of us are in those rooms. And, again, I understand that it's all negotiating and – and things are said and things are done, and I do believe, and people have misunderstood something that I said on TV the other day that I'd like to clarify. They were saying that when I said that this is a new group of owners and this is a new group of players, and these are players that by and large didn't go through 3-4 years of college like the players that were leading the charge in the last lockout. I'm not saying that these guys are uneducated, because I don't know that going to 3-4 years in college necessarily makes you more educated. But when you have spent 3-4 years in college, you understand the system of how things work. You understand the politics. You understand, quite honestly, a little bit more about negotiations because you didn't automatically come in. You weren't promised things right off the bat when you came in. You had to sort of work your way through the system. The players in the last lockout understood that. They understood that there was give and take. This group of guys are just, all they get is, you got owners saying, no, 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 this is what you have to give us or forget it. They've never been treated that way before. So the fact that they had the reaction that they did is not surprising to me.
You know what? This is obviously going to keep going on for another hour. Let's bring this to a part two. Check it out on iTunes or ESPN.com's Pod Center.
Target to set off.
Whoa!
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Pod Center at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.